Hi, and welcome to the Webster University Geneva podcast. I'm Juliana Sandholm-Bark. I'm assistant professor at Webster University Geneva. I do research on historical and contemporary discourses on art and its value, the impact of digitization on the art market, and the emergent art scene in Switzerland. In addition to teaching courses in art history and current art, I just launched Meet the Artist, a public lecture series this spring. With us today, we have our fourth speaker in the Meet the Artist lecture series, Nina Rodin. Nina is a Danish artist who was trained in London and who is based in Switzerland, who has an MA in painting from the Slade School of Fine Arts at UCL and a DPhil in neurophysiology besides. She just had her first Swiss solo show at Andata Ritorno Gallery from March the 1st to the 16th of this year, and has had other solo shows in New York and Maastricht, which makes her a wonderful representative of the artistic scene in Geneva and more globally as well. And she's also the founder and director of the Trélé residency in Switzerland, as well as related residencies in Istanbul, Paris, and the Peruvian Amazon. Welcome, Nina. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
You are so multi-talented, and I'm a little bit overwhelmed, and I don't know where to begin this conversation because there's so many questions I want to ask you. Let's start about your background, discussing your background, which is both in the sciences and the visual arts. You've done something pretty miraculous. I mean, from my perspective, in that you've been living two lives in parallel for a long time. Can you tell us a little bit about how integrated these two parts of your life have been, sciences on one hand and the visual arts on the other?
Yes, so I the focus was from very early on science, because I had a lot of abilities on that front, and I come from a family where art was very important as a hobby. Both my grandmothers painted for decoration, really, and I went to a lot of art museums as a child and was schlepped off to the opera and so on. And so art has been there from a very early stage, but I was a professional scientist right up until 2001, and I didn't you know, sort of miraculously, as you put it, change from being a professional scientist to being a professional artist. It was quite a long transition. I left science because at the back of my drawer in the laboratory at the Brain Research Institute in Zurich, I had an A4 sheet divided down the middle with reasons to stay on one side and reasons to leave on the other. Mm-hmm. And I filled this out till I was kind of writing up the margins on both sides equally. And at the end of 1 year of doing this, I left really because the list existed. I then started doing web design, and took some illustration classes so I could do more logos for people. But, you know, I think it helped that I had this background in art. I had done evening courses before, and I had a year out where I'd studied painting in Florence and in Denmark for a few months each place. But gradually, I think really the point of becoming an artist was the point where, instead of illustrating other people's ideas with my artwork, I started having my own ideas that I wanted to develop in my work. And so from being a part-time foundation student at a point where I'd run out of evening courses to do, I sort of snuck back into the studios a bit more, became sneakily a full-time foundation student, and when everybody else went off to apply for BAs, I did the same, and that put me kind of on a career path to do an MA at the Slade eventually, which was the best 2 years of my life. And 4 degrees later, I've started calling myself a professional artist.
That's impressive. So was it very scary transitioning from one kind of career based in a lab, I imagine, into something a lot less structured in a way? Or was it just as structured? Was it very scary to transition?
I think it was surprisingly demanding. I think what's interesting is that I was not of the art world really at all until I was 30 years old. So I remember very clearly what the art world looked like from outside. And I, along with many people I meet, had this notion that being an artist was really most entertaining, and you just got to sit and draw all day and you know, basically I had this notion I would be doing what I'd been doing for in my time off for a while. This said, I was struck already when I applied for my BA in painting, which I ended up doing at Camberwell, that the application form was much, much more like the application form for my PhD in science than for my bachelor degree in science. And by the time I applied for my MA at the Slade, the application form was much more like that for a PhD, because from a very early point as an artist, your study is really almost entirely self-directed. So you're doing something that's much more akin to research from early on. You're much more on your own. You have to take much more initiative. So it was surprisingly challenging, much more so than I expected. And I very quickly started to say that I had to think more and work harder in the art studio than I did in the laboratory, despite the fact that I did clock 12 to 14 hour days at the lab most days in Zurich. And there was one more thing that was very striking when I started on the BA, was the sense of everyone being an individual in the studio. And that was what my first painting was about. There was an incredible level of sort of me, I want to call it. I mean, it's not, a narcissism that I'm critical of, but more that it is kind of everyone for themselves, because art is about looking in to what makes you individual and original, what is genuinely yours, and what's different. You have to make something that's original, and that's different from what everybody else is doing. So being in the art studio is a very different experience from being in the laboratory, which is much more collaborative. When I left the lab, I left copies of my lab books and of my data and backups of the computer and so on, so that others could continue the research that I had done. If I stopped painting, the work stops. That's it. It stops with me, really. And that's a tremendous responsibility when you're young. And I was happy to be 30 years old and not to be 18 when I started.
I was just going to ask, did you feel that you had a certain advantage, life experience advantage?
Yes. I think it's much easier to start making original art when you're 30, and you have a much longer period of your life where you have differentiated yourself from others. So I can understand now why a lot of my tutors at Camberwell were very keen that I make art about the science that I'd experienced, because I was obviously the only one in the class who had that experience. But that wasn't, I certainly didn't want to start illustrating what I knew about the brain. Still, I was at a point of my life where it was very, very differentiated. I think children tend to all draw very much the same thing. And it takes quite a precocious teenager to produce artwork that isn't in one form or another a copy of what's already out there and being called art. The other thing I think is just in terms of maturity and being able to organize myself. I was, when I started my first degree, I already had my first child, so I'd had to learn the hard way to multitask and be very, very organized in order to juggle a number of things. And and those are things that can be very, very useful in the arts, because it is a massive logistical exercise to put on a big show, for example.
Mm-hmm. So how does one go from being in art school, doing homework, you know, these assignments that are given by a teacher, to creating work on an autonomous basis with nobody telling you what to do? Is that very terrifying?
So actually, it's only the foundation year where you have project-based work in the UK, in any case. And the projects or assignments are very, very loose. So you already have very diverse responses to the assignments. And I think good tutors are very, very good and helpful at helping you understand how you are beginning to differentiate yourself from others and pushing you in directions that that kind of go away from the norm. So I think my experience of art school, like I said, was by the time I was doing an MA, it was kind of more like doing a PhD in science of self-directed research and development. I think the challenge is in trusting in what you do. There's a lot of self-doubt. I talk to a lot of artists through the residencies that I've organized. I've had 125 that have come through my studio in Trelle here in Switzerland. And because what you're doing is specific to yourself as an artist, or should be original to you, it also means that you are the only keeper of approbation or doubt. It's really the aesthetic choice is entirely yours, and that can be a heavy burden to bear, of deciding what to do next, of valuing your own work, remembering to document it, putting it on the website, looking for shows. You really, really have to believe in yourself to go and look for a solo show.
Mm-hmm. I was hoping you could tell us a little bit more about the role that the medium plays in your creative process, because you work in a wide-ranging types of media, print, photography, sculpture, large-scale installation, and painting as well. So I was going to ask you, which of the two comes first, idea or medium?
So for me, it's definitely ideas and concept-based. There's something that I become curious about, and then I start with use the tools that I need for that. At the same time, I have a very a long fascination with the medium of paint. It was very clear to me at the end of my foundation that I was going to apply for a painting course, and in fact, I was lucky to end up in Camberwell, which is one of the last London degrees in painting. So most art degrees in London at the best schools will be in visual arts, or at Central St Martin, for example, you can do the 2D, 2D, 3D or 4D, I think. Those are your free course options. So I really, really wanted to engage with painting. There's something about the sheer visceral mess of it that I can't leave alone. Mm-hmm. I literally dream about it at night. So, but painting itself has become the source of, or the has become the object of conceptual work, because that very attraction and desire that I have for it is kind of unsettling almost. It's sort of, well, what is this thing that's causing me to, in the end, to completely change my career and forget about, both science and web design, which are both, good sound professions, and here I am waking up and needing to go up and go and make a mess. And So I did a huge photographic study where I took macro lenses, took a macro lens into art schools, to my own work, to all the marks that I found in the studios, and did a kind of systematic data collection of the sorts of marks that I made in contemporary art. So it's about paint, but it's photographic, and I've made videos. I mean, work where I'm together with Sarah Neil Jones. We copy each other painting. I've done this with Nicholas John Jones as well, and there are paintings as an output, but the main output is a video. So I will use what I need to, and I don't tend to repeat my work very much, which makes it difficult for the art market. It is difficult to do work that's as varied or as all over the place as mine, perhaps. It's difficult for the art market. It was difficult. I remember interviewing at the Royal College of Art in London for my MA, and had brought 10 works in. I think we were supposed to, or 12. And one of the interviewers said, well, I'm sorry, but these 10 pieces look like they've been made by 10 different people. And I looked at them kind of because I thought that was one of the strengths of my work. I'm more interested in exploring a wide range of ideas and a lot of different concepts, and go where my curiosity takes me. I think as long as it's I'm being true to myself and not responding to what people expect, I feel that that I'm not wasting my life.
So I'm just going to read a quotation from the explanatory, the brochure that I picked up at the exhibition that you had at Andata Ritorno in Geneva in March. So I'm quoting this. It's a show about the complexity of the brain presented through a series of collections of images. Could you tell us a little bit more about the brain and the resulting artworks in this exhibition?
Yes, so despite my initial resistance to have anything to do with the brain when I was studying art in London, I've come to, my work has in the last 5-6 years kind of swung back towards a link with my understanding of modern neuroscience. I think the main development for me that has happened in neuroscience for the last 25 years is a exponential increase in the complexity in our understanding of the complexity of the brain. So for every year that passes, neuroscience seems to uncover yet another little micro mechanism, another little variable that can change in the communication between two nerve cells. And at this point in time, back of the envelope calculation will tell you that the billions of nerve cells that we have in our brain, who on average connect with 1,000 other nerve cells each, that these connections have so many there are so many ways in which the brain cells could connect to each other, so many variables at each connection, that in fact the number of ways in which a human brain can be wired up exceeds the number of elementary particles in the universe. And I think that's just such an incredibly beautiful fact. And in some ways, I feel that as an artist, I am mining that incredible diversity that are the human brains of this world. That, you know, every... 25 years ago, to talk of individuality simply didn't mean the same thing as it does now. When I say I am an individual, I'm not just saying, you know, I'm a bit mad and my hair is rainbow colored or whatever. I mean it, and I know it. I know that every single person that I cross in the street is absolutely an individual. No two brains will ever be in the same state in the history of humanity. Obviously, our own brain is never in the same state twice, but even though we're sitting and sharing this experience right now, our brains are not in the same state and never will be again. And so I feel that as an artist, in some ways, I'm mining this very particular individual brain that I have between my ears. And that the role of art, the beauty and the incredible, very, very specific value of art is to explore that individuality. We have many, many other human activities that are more about consensus, that are more about agreeing and looking at what the overlaps might be between your brain and mine. So we're sitting here nodding at each other. So we obviously have some overlap. We have English in common. Businesses exploit what most of us want or are desperate to know what they could sell to all of humanity. Mm. And art is something different. I feel that it is about this absolute individuality of looking into what makes a person a person.
So what's it like to have a show at a gallery? Does it vary from gallery to gallery? Maybe you could talk a little bit about your experience working with Joseph Farin, just tell us a little bit about what the benefits are of this kind of experience and what are the challenges to you as an artist.
Yes, yeah, so I see the opportunity to do a solo show as an opportunity to take stock. It's quite painful as an artist in some respects because you're forced to kind of look back at work that's completed. The life in the studio tends to kind of be about looking forward and dreaming up the next project and figuring out how you're going to finish this painting, what's still missing, what needs to be taken out, what needs to be added. And you're kind of constantly in a kind of going forward mode. And quite often when I finish a large project, I'd give it barely a second's thought. I'll look at it again, but tend to be on to the next thing. And so for an artist, the opportunity to do a solo show is an opportunity to draw a line at a certain point in time and say, now this. Ideally. But then a lot of different factors come into play, and especially within we're talking really about the art world and the art market to some extent. I think the show at Andata Ritorno was a very unusual and a real privilege to be doing, because Joseph Farine has fewer economic constraints than most. I mean, they're still considerable. And, you know, it's been really, really hard for him to keep going for the 37 years that he has. Mm-hmm. But he has a substantial subsidy from the city of Geneva in the form of free rent. Mm-hmm. And this allowed him to urge me really to be very radical with what I was showing. And we were able to put aside any thoughts of what would sell the best. Now, in Maastricht, where I worked with Max Rutten, the situation is obviously very different. We know each other very well. Max knows my work in great detail. But there is going to be a constraint as to what is more likely to sell, so that Max can pay the rent and the substantial overheads that are entailed by running a contemporary art gallery. So they were different experiences, both very, very important in terms of understanding where I am, and for me to sort of look in the mirror with a whole series of works and think about where I want to go next.
We were talking the other day about Geneva and whether the cultural politics of Geneva encourage people to engage in creative and artsy lives. And at one point you told me that Geneva actually pushes you to work harder because the constraints are significant. And breaking into the art world, which is a relatively closed system in Geneva, can be difficult as well. So the question to you is, how did you do it?
So I think the residencies were a substantial factor in kind of breaking in. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell one anecdote. At the head, the Haute École d'Art et de Design, so the main University of the Arts in Geneva, there were two positions open, and I think one was with web design, it was better than making coffees for people, but it wasn't anything super exciting. Still, mm-hmm. I thought I would have a really good chance of applying for these positions, and mm-hmm. I thought the best thing is to go in and meet people and introduce myself. So they have a face on me because I know I'm an outsider, and also just to understand a little bit whether I would be wasting my time applying or not, because sometimes positions are also advertised obviously with someone in mind already. Now, this wasn't the case, but still, as I kind of worked my way up, I don't know if it was the director or someone sort of with an office of her own, she said to me, we don't normally hire people we haven't worked with already or don't already know. Mm-hmm. And that for me was a massive shock. I mean, I didn't expect that they were just that necessarily to be the number one candidate, but mm-hmm. to actively discourage my application because they didn't already know me felt to me very, very, very sad. I think it's a missed opportunity. I mean, I'm not saying I would have been wonderful at this, but I think particularly within the arts, my experience within the residencies is that it's the residents with whom I have the least in common on paper, or if they were to make an application form, that have taught me the most and have moved my own practice forward, my mm-hmm. own thinking. So, so Geneva is a little bit closed. I think when you do get to know people, people go out of their way to be supportive. So there's always a flip side to local cultures. I've lived and worked in a lot of different countries, and I've always realized that when something feels odd to you coming from outside, it often has a flip side that's very positive.
Mm-hmm.
So now that I know people, I'm starting to know people, I'm really, really moved by how much support and that I'm getting. I think the Switzerland is very, very generous in its support of the arts all mm-hmm. over. There are a lot of grants and quite large grants going mm-hmm. around. There are a lot of well-supported public institutions. But, you know, it is striking that most of them you have to be Swiss to apply to.
Right.
Or you have to have been in the country for 5 years to apply to. In London, you can be South Korean and have arrived 2 months ago and win a large prize in principle. Mm-hmm. You just have to be resident. So those are differences. But mm-hmm. I think having the residency, what I learned, this was from Stephen Frost, who was head of diversity for the London Olympic Games, and I had the honor of meeting him. And he said, when you come from outside and you want to change a system, think not of taking a share of the cake, but how you can add a cherry to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is what the residencies allowed me to do, is that I was bringing in foreign artists, I mean, on a shoestring budget and in my own studio, all by myself in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't just standing there on my own going like, well, I want a share of the cake, you know, give me a solo show. I was like, and in fact, the first show that I got, in inverted commas, was curating a group show from the first 50 residents who had arrived.
Mm-hmm.
I selected 12, and I did a fantastic little show at Gowan Contemporary. And Laura Gowan gave me this opportunity, which was really, really important to me, and giving me confidence in that I would have a role to play in Geneva, because I was, you know, offering not just myself, but the work of others.
More,
and,
yeah.
And we had that in common of wanting mm-hmm. to help other artists.
So I have a bit of a hot button topic question, because it's one of those elephant in the room topics that I think personally must be talked about a lot more if life is to move forward in Switzerland and more globally, which concerns women artists who have children, who have family, who have a life besides their careers. And this is a question of work-life balance. So I've been thinking about this for a while now, but especially ever since very famous performance artist Marina Abramović had an interview with a German newspaper, Tagesspiegel, translated by ArtNet. And in this interview, she said that children hold women back in the art world. That's a quote from Abramović. And this, of course, you can imagine, sparked a media storm. And I do want to bring this up because I know you have three children and you're living proof that women are able to have it all. I mean, you have an artistic career, you have exhibitions, you have solo exhibitions, you have a fabulous network, you're a public person, you've created this Trélat residency, not just in Trélat, but I mean, it's sort of the expanse of that has become global. So you're living proof that women are able to have it all. So I was going to ask you what your stand is on the work-life balance question in the arts and in the context of living in Switzerland specifically.
Okay, so let's start with Switzerland. It was a bit of a culture shock. I mean, I live in a small village. I've also been told that perhaps there are differences between a smaller rural village such as Trélat and the center of Geneva. So it was a culture shock. I mean, first of all the communications from the school, whether verbal, well, especially actually mostly verbal, but they were addressed to the mothers. It was also always about the mothers coming for a talk, or mothers this and mothers that. And you know, that's simply not accepted in the UK anymore.
Mm-hmm.
There were several points where I just actually felt like I'd moved a full generation back in time in terms of what the expectations were. I was told that your children, madame, are very tired in the afternoon because you do not take them home at lunch for 2 hours and you leave them in the canteen every day.
Mm.
I was like, all right. About a year in, this is just a personal anecdote, but about a year in, it was International Women's Day, and there was an article in the in The Economist that I read, ranking 37 countries in the world for which there were the 37 countries were very developed countries, because they had taken 12 different metrics on women's access to work. And this included equal pay, access to childcare, discrimination at work, and such measurements. On 37 countries, the first one was New Zealand, where we nearly moved instead of coming here. I was like, oh, damn. Number 37 was Japan, number 36 was South Korea, and in place number 35 was Switzerland. Mm. So that actually reassured me that it wasn't just me, right. At least that this was something that that is really, really is a problem in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And, you know, above Switzerland were most of the Eastern Bloc countries, most of Europe, you know, Italy, Spain, Greece. I don't know. It came as a shock to be ranked behind all the Mediterranean countries, because I grew up in the south of France, and like I say, a generation ago. So that's one issue. I think the Swiss don't like being last at anything, so I'm sure they're going to do something about it. And look forward to be part of it. Mm-hmm. In terms of being an artist, I think there is a I'm going to talk a little bit more generally about what art is, and that it is something that is linked to me, that has to be genuine, that has to be original, and it has to be sincere. So original, you can look at what's out there and see if the artwork that's being produced is new and novel is at least interesting, as they say. In terms of things being genuine and sincere, you actually find that within the art world, very much depends on trust. And I think, you know, the role of the gallerist in some respect is to have that close one-to-one relationship with the artist and be able to translate this trust or connection that they feel with an artist and tell the customer, the person who might want to own the art, that this is genuine, that this is sincere, that the artwork has those values. And this is, I think, one of the reasons that artworks that show a certain level of obsession or passion or a sort of something close to madness those are kind of attractive qualities in art, because you when you see something that has taken, you know, 1,000 hours to realize, you start to sense that it's unlikely that it's been faked. You know, the painting that has taken a very, very long time to paint with a tiny paintbrush tends to be ranked higher than the quick snapshot that's, you know, been printed by someone else. I don't think necessarily the painting is necessarily the better artwork, but that's another question. Just that there is this it feels safer to go for the artwork that's where the artist has been 100% engaged. Now, with mother artists, I think there's the sense that, but art is not your only passion, right? Because it's your children. Mm-hmm. And so that perhaps you are not 100% with it. And yes, my children are going to come before my artwork in a bind. That's, mm-hmm. But it's a very, very different sort of love and of passion. And the love I have for my children cannot sustain me intellectually. It's something that's very animal in some respects. I mean, don't get between me and my children, because I will bite you. But don't get between me and my art either, because my brain would die. I could not be a good mother if I wasn't allowed to follow my passion and be the artist that I am. In terms of Marina Abramovic, I mean, what to say? I hope that those are the last words of a generation past, and that such choices will not remain necessary. I think the world is changing for the better in terms of understanding as well that the best output in life, whether economic or artistic, is not necessarily produced by 80-hour weeks in the office. I mean that you something better and more meaningful can be done in a short time. I think we're learning that as a species. I think that men are slowly trying to understanding that being a father is a privilege, and it's not something that they should defend themselves against. I was lucky in that respect. My husband made it clear from the beginning that he wanted to change exactly half the nappies, that it was his right. Mm-hmm. I thought, great. But, you know, there are a lot, you're up against a lot of prejudice, a lot of difficulties, and even and you have to be a woman to understand that in some respect. You have to experience it on a daily basis. It can be absolutely disheartening to always... it's a really difficult, it's a huge challenge. But I don't feel that I have a choice. And I think I remember as well the letters to a young poet by Rainer Maria Rilke, and how important that advice was of, if you must do it, you will. Like, look within yourself, and you have this sense that there's no choice. For me, there's no choice. I mean, I don't know where my artwork will go. It might end up in a skip after I die. It's, you know, I just have to do it. So in some respects, that's that. Mm-hmm. And I think being a mother has given me incredible skills on the multitasking front, on being organized. It's taught me to get up at the crack of dawn, which turns out to be an incredibly productive time. Mm-hmm. And not to, you know, when you have three children, you also learn that things can look like you are dropping all the balls and, you know, you land on your feet at the end of the day. And I think that's a really, really good experience to have with in the arts as well. Mm-hmm. So yes, and I think the final bit of advice to mothers out there, artist mothers perhaps, is to think of those days, months, year perhaps, where you can't get to the studio as loading a spring. So think of that frustration that you have as a tremendous energy and force that is building up within you. Mm-hmm. And save it, keep a notebook at least, write down all those ideas, all those things that you feel you cannot do, that you've been kept from doing. Because you will, life is long these days, we live much, much longer, and you will get back to the studio. And then, you know, suddenly you'll have one of those days where you're like, blank canvas day, what do I do today? So having loading that spring, I think, can be really useful to have a year where you can't get to the studio and you start sorting in your mind, well, what am I going to do first when I get back to the studio? What's most important? What is the artwork that I need to do before I die? What if I die in a year? What's the thing that I... And I think that's that you can achieve an incredible amount in your mind, and practice in your mind, practice art, even if you can't get to the studio.
Thank you, Nina, for being so open and for sharing so many insights about you and your work. And that piece of advice to women artists was really special. So thank you very much for being here. And I wish you all the success in the world.
Thank you very much, Juliana.